Chapter 4. More than any other Shadowkin, orcs favor a bone motif when decorating. They place skulls on pikes, weave teeth into their bead necklaces, and stick tusks and femurs onto just about every surface. Orcish wise ones even developed an alphabet using the hand and foot bones of their foes, though it was usually just painted on stone in bone shapes. Otherwise, it took at least three corpses to write a sentence, and the writer would still likely run out of vowels. No matter what the occasion, orcs incorporate skeletons into the ornamentation, and the more momentous or grim the event, the more bones they bring to decorate. Even still, the funeral of an orcish chieftain is a grim affair even by their own macabre standards. The faces of the Shadowkin around Char Gusvarda's pyre were painted as white death masks so that they looked like ghosts at the edge of the firelight. Bone totems, skeletal trophies, and assorted teeth had been piled atop the pyre. Ashurzu wondered if there was any wood beneath the dull white decorations. The only bones missing from Char's pyre were those of Char himself. The lightlings still had them, along with the rest of Char's body. This brought shame on the Gusvarda tribe, who cremated their dead primarily so the fallen wouldn't become grim trophies. Whether or not the Lightlings had any propensity to decorate their homes and fortresses with Char's bones was irrelevant. The fact that they could cast an even darker pall over the funeral. Ashurzu stifled a sob and looked up at Darek. Tears of rage and grief ran down her younger brother's cheeks in rivulets, carving channels through his thick face paint. She placed a hand on his elbow, and he placed his forehead on her shoulder. He leaned on her long after the pyre had crumbled into coals, past the hour when the younglings were sent to bed and the workers had retired to their huts and tents. Later, the siblings sat atop a pair of boulders painted like great skulls, watching the groups of warriors and wise ones whisper in hushed tones around the beach. The ashes of the chieftain's pyre were not yet cool, but talk had already turned to finding a new leader for the Gusvarda. Orcish politics were deceptively complex. Technically, trial by combat determined the leadership of any orcish tribe. To the outsider, that seemed to imply that the biggest, strongest orc always led the tribe, but several nuances meant that this wasn't always the case. An orc could have a champion stand for him or her in combat, provided there was a willing representative. There were customs and laws about how challenges were fought, but they all agreed that a chieftain could be called to defend his or her throne at almost any time. When public opinion swayed too far against an orcish monarch, a challenge would quickly end his career, if not his life. If a tribe had a bitter disagreement with even numbers on both sides, the tribe would split, and the fragments would settle the matter through good, honest war. The most important quality of an orcish leader is having enough followers to stave off challenges from his or her political opponents. The second most important quality is possessing enough political skill to keep the tribe from breaking apart. The death of a chieftain always marked the beginning of a search for such a candidate. Ashurzu only caught snippets of the conversations playing up beneath them. Gizardu the Mountain was considering a bid to become chieftain and withdraw the Gusvarda from the Red Horde, though she was herself a follower of the old ways. Borpo Skarizod wanted to lead, though that wasn't a surprise. The Gusvarda tribe had been the Skarizod tribe at various points in its history, and Borpo's family perpetually schemed to take back the throne. Of most interest to Ashurzu was Kagar's bid. Kagar was a wise one, but if he could find a warrior to stand for him, then it was possible that her father's old ally could take the throne. Ashurzu craned her neck a little to hear what the old orc was saying to Dorgan of the Great Axe, but she couldn't quite make it out.
"Go, Ashurzu," said Darek, breaking his long silence. "What do you speak of?"
Ashurzu feigned a stretch and turned back to her brother.
"You cannot hide yourself from me," said Darek. "Look at how you toy with your moth necklace. Anyone can see that you long to peddle words amongst the wise ones and would-be chieftains."
Ashurzu shook her head and touched her brother's arm.
"I would hate to see you alone on such a night, little warg," she told him. "And I would hate to stop my favorite sister from being my favorite sister,"
Darek forced a smile.
go. Speak with them. I will be fine.
Ashurzu pursed her lips, an uncommon expression for a people with tusks jutting from their lower jaw. It didn't seem right to leave Darek by himself at such a time, but missing a chance to help steer the fate of her family's tribe seemed too great a waste to bear. She pressed her forehead to Darek's cheek before she left him, because kisses are also uncommon expressions for a people with tusks. The young Orcus spoke briefly with Kagar, who asked for her aid in bringing Gizardu and her allies to his side. It was hard to conceal her excitement, and she couldn't stifle the wide grin on her face as she approached Gizardu and several of her followers.
"Hail, Ashurzu, daughter of Zerthraka," said Gizardu the Mountain.
The warrior's honorific once referred to her size, for she was almost as tall as the male orcs, but over time it had come to signify her deeds as well. The bones and skulls hanging from her armor attested to Gizardu's glorious exploits in battle. Her hair was a raven mane, long and unbraided in the way of warriors, and she gave Ashurzu a lioness stare as she approached.
"Have you come to give us your support?" "Truly you would be worthy of it, mighty Gizardu," said Ashurzu, "but I come to ask for your strength instead, for Kagar the Wise."
The warrior frowned.
"Kagar may be wise, but he follows your father's ways. I am not sure they are right for this tribe. In my father's days, the children ate every day, and parents came home to see them," said Ashurzu. "Can the same be said for the reign of my brother?" "What you say is true," said one of Gizardu's retinue, "but our people crave conquest. We live for the thrill of battle."
"It is so," Ashurzu agreed. "That is why I love the path of the aggressive seller. Truly, nothing is better than to crush your competition, to drive down their profit margins, to hear the lamentations of their sales representatives. It was a thrill we knew once, a conflict as glorious as any battle. And the children ate at the end of each day."
"You speak well," said Gizardu slowly, "and I will have younglings of my own some day, should I find a warrior worthy of siring them. In such dark times, I forget the joy we knew in the days before the Lightling's betrayal. But I cannot forget their betrayal, and I don't know that the tribe will either."
Ashurzu tried not to flinch at the mention of the betrayal. She had personally feasted and laughed with the Lightling heroes who claimed to be restoring her tribe's sacred burial stones. When Gorm Ingerson's alleged kindness turned out to be a ruse that brought the gold hounds down upon her people, the pain cut her family deepest of all. Stealing her resolve, she met Gizardu's piercing gaze.
"We must learn from that treachery, but that does not mean we must flee from it. That is what the Lightling dogs want," she said. "They don't regret us starving in the wilderness, pillaging wealth for the Goldhounds to loot. They resented our success on the path of the aggressive seller."
Gizardu had a thoughtful gleam in her eyes.
"Your words are wise, Ashurzu, and you honor your family. But even if you speak the truth, how will you and Kagar get us back onto Zerthraka's path? None of us have our life papers, and even our younglings are hunted by the Goldhounds."
Ashurzu had anticipated the question.
"In truth, I do not know," she said, "but I am searching for a way, and we need a chieftain who will help us find the path. I have spoken to many of the Gizvarda, and they tire of the Red Horde."
"Was your brother one of them?"
asked another of Gizardu's followers. Ashurzu followed the warrior's gaze back to Darek. Her brother was surrounded by a pack of orcs, goblins, and gnolls, each wearing a red patch on the left shoulder. And at their center stood Grignot, bent over by the weight of the bones hanging from his wiry form. Ashurzu frowned.
"A thousand pardons, great Gizardu. I am needed."
"I will think on your words," said Gizardu.
With a bow and a few more excuses, Ashurzu broke away and rushed back across the beach to where Darek and Grignot spoke.
"Honor, Lady Ashurzu," said Grignot. "Your brother and I were just discussing the future of the Red Horde." They wish me to be chieftain, Ashurzu,
Darek said without ceremony.
And I am sure you would be a mighty one.
Ashurzu spoke with cautious diplomacy. The wrong words could dishonor Darek, but a different sort of wrong words might imply that his leadership wasn't a terrible idea.
But you have often said you had no desire to lead. Is it not what Char would have wanted?
Asked Grignot.
I am sure Char would want what's best for the tribe, said Ashurzu carefully. Indeed!
Pressed Grignot.
Is it not good and rightful that the Gazvarda should lead the Gazvarda tribe? Who would challenge mighty Darek if he chose to take up his brother's cause to finish the work of his honored ancestors? But,
Ashurzu began,
it does sound like something Brother Char would say,
Darek said slowly. A crocodilian smile spread over Grignot's face as he nodded to Ashurzu.
Your brother seems a most suitable candidate to me,
he said. Look at that smarmy grin, the snaggle-toothed smile. The eyes are so small and beady, and not even pointing in the same direction, Peraldin sputtered as he waved the wanted poster in the air. The flyer promised a 10,000 gilton reward for the bard's capture or death, a summary of his crimes, and a woodcut portrait that looked like the printer had decided to try postmodern cubism. I'd be offended if this looked anything like me, or if it looked anything like a human.
Would you be quieter, too?
Asked Gorm.
Gods, you should be thankful they hired such a terrible artist. We're across the street from the city guardhouse.
Vechel had several guard posts built into its stone walls, but the guards inside had insisted that Gorm and his party take their report into the main office near the center of the city. The great stone building was the only one visible through the narrow alley that Gorm and his companions had pressed into. Easy for you to say, grumbled the bard, looking at the flyer listing the reward for Gorm's capture. My poster has a mutant turnip on it.
Gods, let it go, growled Laruna. Yes, and keep your cowl up, said Caitha. Nobody will know we're outlaws unless you do something conspicuous.
Like rip up wanted posters, added Jin. Well, listen to a bunch of marks try to teach me about stealth. Heraldin tossed the scraps of his poster into the gutter. Trust me, if someone notices six cloaked figures huddled in a dark alley, a cheap, inaccurate poster is the least of their concerns. Geist knows what I mean. Geist stood absolutely still, but the manner in which he stared at the street opposite Heraldin was reminiscent of a heavy sigh.
All the more reason to get moving, said Gorm. Come on, we filter in like we planned, and if it all goes to the goblins...
Offensive,
Bert muttered from within his pack.
Right, sorry. If it all goes... bad, we get out fast and make for the north gate.
Caitha and Laruna left the dark alley first, then Geist, followed by Heraldin. Finally, Gorm and Jin set out, winding through the street shops and food carts that littered the roads surrounding the guardhouse. Caitha and Laruna sat at a bench by the front door, pretending to have a casual conversation as they kept watch. Vechel's guardhouse was lit by sunlight filtered through stained glass windows and the orange light of tarnished lamps. A heavy quiet draped over the room like an old blanket as motes of dust danced lazily in the sunbeams to the rhythm of the creaks in the wooden floors. Heraldin and Geist sat at a guest table, making a good show of reading a few tourism pamphlets placed by the Vechel Chamber of Commerce. A row of desks lined the back wall, each marked by small signs encouraging guests to see the next one. The last desk was manned by a tall man with a hawk nose, a long mustache, and a fine breastplate embossed with wreaths of roses. He reclined with his heavy boots up on the blotter of his desk, idly flipping through a salacious magazine with a woodcut of a scantily clad ogress on the cover. He didn't look up as Gorm and Jin approached.
"We've come with a warning for the city of Vechel," said Gorm. "There is an undead Form 89 MC.
The guard pointed toward a set of shelves in the back lined with neat stacks of paperwork, without looking up.
What? There's no time for filling out forms, said Gorm.
The guard licked his thumb and flipped the page.
If you need to expedite the paperwork, you'll also need to fill out Form 93MM.
Gorm could feel the blood rising in his cheeks.
How does more bloody paperwork make things go faster?
The guardsman shrugged. Vetchel is in dire peril. Jin leaned over the desk. If you cannot take this threat seriously, then we must speak with the commanding officer at this station. The guard finally glanced up from his book, meeting Jin's stare with his own heavy-lidded eyes.
Go right ahead, sir.
You're the commander of the city guard, said Jin dryly.
Knight commander of the city guard, yes. Lord Tyrone Athos to you.
And you spend your days taking in the paperwork.
Gorm couldn't have concealed his skepticism even if he'd tried.
I've always believed it's important to delegate. Staying off the streets and ramparts gives me more time to...
Tyrone's hand grasped idly at nothing, as though he could pull the right words from the air.
You know, set the direction of my department, do the big picture thinking.
I see.
Gorm glanced at the guard's magazine cover. It promised in bold block letters that everything was bigger with ogresses.
A man of vision, then?
Indeed,
said Knight Commander Urthos, flipping the page. Gorm snorted, and as he did so, his nose caught a biting scent.
And you're drunk!
I'm hiding it well, countered the Knight Commander.
Hiding it? Said Jin. Who cares what you look like if you're too sauced to help us?
Oh, no.
Tyrone held up a finger with the deliberate steadiness of a man just on the edge of inebriation.
I'm not that drunk. I'm not helping you yet, because you haven't done the paperwork.
But this is a matter of life and death, said Gorm.
All the more reason to do it properly,
said Tyrone with a tight-lipped smile.
It won't do you much good to moan about how critical this threat is if you can't be bothered to fill out a few simple forms.
All of Arth could be in danger, Jin protested.
Well, then be sure to include Form 78 MCA when you file your report.
The Knight Commander turned back to his magazine. That's the blue one.
Fine, thrice curse your bones,
Gorm snapped, already on his way to the shelves of papers. He located all three forms, as well as a few quills and a pot of ink. On his way back to the lobby, he nodded at Heraldin and Gaste.
You two, come help with the bloody paperwork.
They huddled around a small table in the lobby, working furiously. There were questions about the date and location that the threat was witnessed, the quantity and relative power of the foes, the immediate and long-term risks posed by the incursion, and naturally several pages of detailed questions about the weapons, armor, and other valuables that the enemy might have been carrying. Gorm and his companions scrawled their best guesses in most of the blanks, and progress was fast until they reached the questions about their identities.
They want names, license numbers, addresses, muttered Jin. If we gave any of these to the guild, they'd be as likely to arrest us as ride out against the undead.
And if I had to choose who to fight, it'd be us, said Heraldin. Just use fake information.
Can't. They cross-check the answers, and if something doesn't match up, the guild will throw out the forms as fraud.
Gorm shook his head.
Do we know anyone else who can submit it? Asked Jin.
A thought struck Gorm, and he turned back to the Knight Commander.
Hey! Can we turn in these reports anonymously?
Tyrone's expression turned puzzled.
I don't think so, but I don't know why you would want to anyway. You'd forfeit any claim to the loot.
Claim?
Gorm feigned ignorance.
To the loot, yes.
Tyrone spoke as though explaining wooden toys to a dull-witted child.
You submit a threat report, and if you're the first to accurately report it, you and the city get to issue a quest together. Then you get some of the gold when the Heroes Guild comes and kills the monsters.
Why else would every bit of riffraff in the street be in here trying to convince me they saw scargs in their barn or big rats in the sewer? The last sentiment was muttered as the Knight Commander returned to his lecherous periodical.
But we don't care about the gold, said Gorm.
Tyrone put his magazine down with forceful impatience.
Don't care about gold? Why would you even...
he began. But then revelation washed over his face.
This is a real threat. You're coming to warn us because there's a real foe marching on the city.
Finally,
said Jin, looking relieved.
And it's not just that you're not here for the loot. You don't want to claim
the loot, so you must have some sort of problem with the law, said the Knight Commander. Jin's enthusiasm faded.
Wait for it, said Gorm.
He had been around long enough to know the difference between making threats and establishing leverage. An avaricious gleam was in the Knight Commander's eye.
And that means that perhaps you wouldn't care if someone else put his name on the forms.
And there it is, Gorm said, stepping forward. And if it happened to be your name on the form?
Now that's a thought, Tyron put on the pretense of pondering. The idea had never crossed my mind, of course, but since you've put it out there, I suppose I would have to personally ensure that the report was seen by the highest offices of our fine city. If my name were on the report, of course.
And if not, Gorm prompted,
why, I'd treat it with all the respect and care that I give to every other request. The Knight Commander jabbed a thumb over his shoulder at a tray brimming with colorful bundles of paper. The rank and file process forms and send them over to the Heroes Guild on a bi-weekly basis.
Of course, said Gorm. A man of vision and an entrepreneur as well.
Jin sighed. Why is nothing ever simple? It was surprisingly difficult to find a venue for not having a meeting. An enterprising individual had many options when searching for a place to meet in Andoran. There were business complexes with offices for rent, taverns with spacious back rooms, and even a few temples that would rent out their sanctuaries for a generous donation to the appropriate god or goddess. Yet all of those options were in public spaces and kept payment records and were full of prying eyes, all of which were unacceptable to a person planning a meeting that would explicitly never happen. Guests who would most definitely be elsewhere demanded much more discretion from a venue that they weren't visiting. The Moonless Night had been established for just such a lack of an occasion. The night was never in the same place twice. Officially, it was never anywhere, and why were you asking anyway? Its clientele expected amenities such as unique and discreet locations to not hold meetings in, well-crafted fake receipts for the expenses they didn't incur, and a stylish invitation sent to everyone who would not be attending, complete with custom alibis written out on the back. On the evening of the 13th of Fulgen, 7375, somewhere in the ninth tier of Andoran, there was not a meeting at the Moonless Night. There were no servants in the alleged room. Any wine and cheese would have been served by conjured sprites that dissipated as soon as they were no longer needed. Only scurrilous and totally unverifiable accounts might have implied that the most dangerous men on Arth gathered to discuss business, and that there were also some assassins present. Fenrir Goldson and Bulby Bags could easily prove that they weren't anywhere near the ninth tier that night. However, anyone who might have been at the Moonless Night that evening may have recalled two similar businessmen opening the meeting by asking several pointed questions. How hard could it really be to kill a party of six heroes, especially if said heroes were led by a rank one warrior and the highest ranked among them was a known drunk for Tando's sake? Hadn't the Solomancer in question spent over a decade as an apprentice? Weren't there ballads about their Noctomancer's cowardice and incompetence? Why were two anonymous businessmen spending so much of their personal fortune on a gaggle of assassins who had yet to eliminate one target? How was it that the wanted posters plastered all over the Freedlands had been just as effective when they had cost a fraction of just one assassin's fee? On the last question, one of the two unidentifiable executives may have thrown a bundle of papers on the table for effect. Each flyer had a poorly rendered woodcut depicting one member of Gorm Ingerson's party or another, alongside the promise of a hefty reward from the Heroes Guild. A couple of the assassins likely protested. Someone might have pointed out that Gorm Ingerson had been ranked 10 at one point, and regardless of guild paperwork, he remained as crafty and dangerous as ever. And had not Throden the Raven's remains been found in a mangled state, his wounds consistent with victims of either a troll attack or an avalanche? coupled with the final report of the Silver Talons mercenaries. Yet if any executives were present, they wouldn't have tolerated such whining. They would remind everyone that assassins are typically paid for results, not excuses, and they would likely have added that there were only two types of assassins, successful professionals and loose ends. The meeting that never happened ended on that veiled threat. The anonymous businessmen pulled up the hoods of their fine capes and made for the doors. Upon their exit, fresh sprites drifted in and began packing up the Moonless Knight's tableware. The assassins would have grumbled about getting the loose ends speech from civilians, but soon enough they would make for the windows and leap out onto the rooftops, their dark cloaks trailing after them in a suitably dramatic fashion. One assassin, however, lingered. He picked up a wanted poster bearing a horrible woodcut of Gorm Ingerson in a hand that wasn't a hand at all. Rather, his appendage was an intricate amalgam of Scribkin engineering and noctomancy, fashioned to look like shining talons. The claws were so sharp that Gorm Ingerson's fish-eyed portrait was shredded when his mechanical hand balled into a shaking fist around it. The tatters of Gorm's malformed image hadn't yet settled on the floor before Gerald Flynn left a meeting that never happened.